been flying discs have been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
Okay, we'll assume it's friendly anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they stayed the exact same spot the whole time. They're out far, let me say that.
Oh my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh Jesus, please be a plane. Oh please. Are you ready for this?
The cameraman said, what the hell is that? Midway across the Hudson River was a perfectly circular disc.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me there'd be days like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello. Been having some mouth problems lately, and I'd hoped to have it fixed before now, and it's still not. So this edition, number 358 of Strange Days, is a little tardy. And yet another busy one it is, with Dave Furlott and fresh from the UFO RetroCon 3 at Big Rock in the California desert, Canadian documentary maker Paul Kimball, newcomer and contributor to Alien Worlds magazine Brittany Babakayoff, and the host of Radio Mysterioso and author and researcher Greg Bishop. And taking us home, as he usually does every second program, Alfred Lemberg. So, let's kick it off with contributing editor and observer of the oddities around the UFO scene, Dave Furlott.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Furlott.
The UFO updates list has always been an interesting forum that allows people to discuss anything and everything related to UFOs. And because the medium of instant communications is available to us with forums like the UFO Updates List, we live in interesting times, which is a phrase reputed to be an old Chinese curse. The truth of the matter is that it means we can get almost instant information about anything through the magic of the Internet and the availability of instant mail for communication purposes. Although it can be argued that telephone and satellite communications are faster, the reality is that the Internet and forums like the UFO Updates List provide the ability for a huge audience from all over the world to have both instant and simultaneous access to any information available. And, unlike watching or listening to news on the radio or television, it also allows the audience to provide their input in the discussion. But something has become evident when instant communication and a little thing I call instant opinion. We can have instances of what I can only call the big lie. If the big lie sounds familiar to you, it is because it was the phrase used by the Nazi Minister of Propaganda, Joseph Goebbels, in World War II. Recently, on the UFO updates list, there have been two instances of what I call the big lie, and as a result, there has been some discussions and posts about them. One concerned a supposed secret meeting held at the United Nations, where the subject of UFOs and aliens was on the agenda. And the other concerns a long video of a supposed autopsy of an alien creature. Now, I call them the big lie because it didn't take long for people to discover evidence showing that both the story of a secret meeting and the video of this supposed autopsy were nothing but fiction, which shows the power of this instant communication with which we have become accustomed. We've had other big lies over the years that have taken much longer to discover were lies, simply because our communications network was so much slower to garner opinion and evidence. And some of these lies include the original alien autopsy film created by Ray Santilli and the story of an alien encounter by Jonathan Reed. They were two of the biggest lies. Now, what gets me about these lies is, although evidence abounds that proves the people involved are lying to us, including even some outright confessions of guilt, there are still people out there that believe the original story. I think it was Goebbels who stated that the bigger the lie, the easier it would be for people to believe it. And it appears that the field of ufology proves that theory. Now, don't get me wrong. I firmly believe that our planet is being visited by craft and beings from some other planet or time, but just because I believe, this does not mean that I'm some woolly sheep that will buy into every story and hoax that surface about aliens or UFOs. And I urge others to tread carefully when they hear or see something that sounds or appears to be too good to believe. It's like the scams that are pulled on a daily basis by people on an unsuspecting public. If something appears too good to believe, it more than likely is. We need to maintain a healthy skepticism about anything we hear or see, and until something can be proved beyond a reasonable shadow of a doubt to be true, it should remain suspect. The simplest thing is to examine the people or the surrounding parts of any claim to determine if any falsehoods have taken place. In the instance of the secret UN meeting, it became suspect when the main witness to the event was shown to have lied to us about his credentials and claimed to be associated with groups that forced him to come clean when they threatened legal action against him. In the case of the new alien autopsy film, there was little doubt that what was being shown was a very nice special effects scene for some upcoming movie or television show. But it did cause a little stir because the original flim-flam of Ray Santilli's alien autopsy got to surface again, albeit briefly. Fortunately for all of us, Errol Bruce Knapp moderates the UFO updates list, so we don't have to go through the pain of beating a dead horse over and over again. Thank you, Errol. Now, with instant communication, instant opinion, and the big lie, there really is no doubt that we live in interesting times. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange days, indeed.
And it was a good one too, Dave Furlong.
Thank you.
No, and thank you for thanking me. Oh, Lord, that thing popped up again, and I thought, oh, here comes the gang who really want to push upon us the fact that they believe that the autopsy footage is real. And sure enough, I got a couple of submissions that didn't make it to the list.
Yes, we have, unfortunately, beaten that horse to death. It's like I said, it is one of those situations where people just refuse to believe the truth. It's like, you got to look at it, and you got to sort of go, guys, when people come forward and they say, look, I'm sorry, I lied, or I did it for fun, or I did it to whatever, take what they're saying and sort of go, yeah, okay, fine, thank you, go away.
And I really didn't expect a network like Fox to pay me a bajillion dollars for the exclusive use of the footage.
Yes, exactly. And unfortunately, some of those things did make a lot of money, including even the Reed piece. He made a fair chunk of cash off of that.
Yeah, Jonathan Reed, who was exposed by the UFO watchdog, Royce J. Myers.
Yes. Unfortunately for us, that he did do that.
I guess you can call the Fox Network the Gullible Network.
Well, the Fox Network is also the one that liked to show one of my favorite conspiracy theory hoaxes, which is we did not land on the moon.
Well, you know, there's always an audience for that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Probably way more than the seriously interested in UFOs.
Yeah, that's
And
true.
A lot of people who don't know any better and whose minds are so open that their brains fall out.
The old trick with conspiracy theories is sprinkle a little bit of truth in there and then you're going to get the story believed. Pop in the big lie whenever you feel like it, because you're going to get away with it. It's going to slide through.
Yeah, curiously enough, the day we recorded this, I got a warning about hypodermic needles being hidden in the handles of the gas pump nozzle. And that is someone who is in the Canadian UFO field. And I thought, what are you doing? Let me go look and just pull a key sentence out of here, because it talked about the fact that it was a warning from the Ontario Provincial Police.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I pulled a key sentence out of it and Googled it, and lo and behold, up it popped as bogus and a hoax.
You'll get one of those people, and eventually they'll say, oh yeah, well I know, because I talked to a friend of mine who had this happen to them.
It came from a reliable source is the other one.
Oh yeah, that's always a good one. It's a reliable source. Mm-hmm. One of the best places is Snopes.
That's where I found the hypodermic in the nozzle handle.
Snopes has made a big website that just covers all of the urban legends. It's the same thing with needles in the change area of payphones. Falls into the same category.
Coin return slot.
Exactly, that's it.
I'm still totally bewildered by the people in the UFO field who are gullible enough to go for this garbage.
I get a Yahoo email every now and again from a friend of mine, and it says, unless you send this out to everyone on your Yahoo email list, you're going to have to start paying for Yahoo. And it's like, excuse me? What?
My other favorite is Bill Gates is going to send you $200 if you circulate this email.
Yes.
Because he's feeling particularly philanthropic today. Yeah, right.
It's amazing how many people just buy into all of that stuff. Like I said, it is the big lie. And the bigger the lie, the more they buy into it.
Every day I get at least half a dozen emails suggesting that I need to update my PayPal information.
Oh, yes.
And go to this website. And the way to spot phonies from supposedly large organizations is, and particularly like PayPal, mm-hmm. because most everybody who's hearing this is a PayPal user, unless it says your address from PayPal to your address, it's a phony. Don't click anything. Trash it.
Yeah.
Yet another service from Strange Days, indeed.
Try and keep some of our listeners safe from some of the crap that goes on out there.
There's just far too much garbage out there, and thank you for once again pointing it out, Dave Furlott.
Quite welcome.
Be interesting to see what you bring up next time.
Yes, well, we'll see.
Yes.
Depends on
what's going on out there.
What's going on.
And there doesn't seem to be too much going on out there at the moment.
Not a heck of a lot. Just
other
a
than
bit.
Certain websites still promulgating the UN thing. No,
oh.
Not publishing a retraction, or they're just putting it out there and putting it out there. And, well, it's up to you to make up your mind.
Yeah, yeah.
Please. Please. Till next time, Dave.
For sure.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Giant rock in the California desert, close to the Yucca Valley. This past week, there was a convention there. And a whole bunch of people showed up for that to speak and to attend. Among those speakers showing his film UFOs, The Best Evidence, was Paul Kimball. Paul is on the line with us from California. He's staying with Greg Bishop, host conference. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Errol. How are things back in Canada?
Just as strange as they ever was.
Suckers. Oh, wait, I have to come home in a couple of days, so I probably shouldn't be making fun of you people up north, should I?
No, you shouldn't, because you do tend to come home to roost, which is, I guess, is appreciated by a lot of people, including our listeners.
Not in Halifax, it isn't. Every time I leave Halifax, there's a mob with pitchforks and flaming torches at the airport saying, no, don't come back, Dr. Kimballstein.
Next time it won't be pitchforks, it'll be a stake.
Ah, well, as long as it's well done. Ba-dum-bum, hey, thank you. We're here twice on Sunday, folks.
The UFO Retro Conference is kind of almost a throwback to the old days of the contactees, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. Giant Rock is where the original conferences for the contactees were taking place in the 1950s. And Greg can talk more about that. That's his area of expertise. There's a lot of UFO conferences out there. Some are good, some are bad, depending on the lineup of speakers. But if you want to go to one that's just cool, not literally because it's quite hot out in Yucca Valley near Giant Rock, but if you want to go to one that's figuratively cool, Retro UFO was the one to go to. Not just because of the speakers, but because you get to go to the Integratron. Regardless of what you think of the contactees and the contactee movement, the Integratron and Giant Rock are a piece of not just ufological history, they're, I think, a very important piece of American cultural history. And so to go there, particularly for me, being a filmmaker and presenting a case on the 10 best UFO cases of all time, at the center of the contacteeism, I thought was somewhat ironic, but I get to show it in the Integratron, and whatever, again, whatever else you think of Van Tassel and Adamski and the contactees, the Integratron's a really, really nifty structure, and it's an awful lot of fun. So even if you couldn't make the Retro UFO conference this year, you should, if you're in southeastern California, in the desert near Mojave and Yucca Valley and Joshua Tree, find your way there and take a look. You can drive out to Giant Rock, too. The Integratron's fenced off. It's owned by private citizens. You can make arrangements to go in and visit, but you have to do that in advance. But Giant Rock, anybody can drive out to that. Indeed, they do. Dirt bikers go out there and dirt bike on the old runway that they used to fly people in on when they were holding the conferences or meetings back in the 1950s and 60s. And my background originally is history before anything else, music, law, film, all those other things I've done. I studied history. So present the film right in a piece of still living, quite frankly, American history was a fascinating experience. And everybody else had been presenting up till that point out in a tent. And as soon as they set me up to do the film in the Integratron, all the speakers who came after me, Bishop Redfern, Ken Thomas, they were all like, how come Kimball gets to speak in the Integratron? And we have to go out in this tent. The sweaty, ugly tent, as Greg was just saying. So all the speakers after me spoke in the Integratron. So I was a bit of a trailblazer in the modern contactee speaker movement, at the very least.
How did your film go down there?
Greg wrote a little note on UFO Mystic, the blog he does with Nick Redfern, about that, and he said it was a frank discussion. Some of the audience didn't appreciate Paul Kimball's frank answers about the UFO, about some of their questions.
Oh, that's a first.
Yeah, well, go figure. What a shocking surprise.
Yeah, what a surprise.
Unlike Greg, I didn't get any questions about reptilians in the alien autopsy film. So I didn't have to answer Ray Santilli and David Icke. But I got some pretty good questions about the Phoenix Lights, the Mexican UFO wave, Stephenville and O'Hare, that kind of stuff. And after the film was done, I talked at fairly great length, which somebody recorded, they were recording all this, so at some point I'll stick it up on YouTube, about the Condon Report and the Condon Effect and all of that sort of stuff. Well, I even mentioned a case from Canada. There are two in the film, of course, Shag and the Yukon case, but I also mentioned the case that Chris Stiles likes so much from Halifax in the 1970s that was investigated by the RCMP. I wrote it on my blog a while ago. It's a very high, strange, sort of Jacques Vallée kind of case where one set of witnesses is seeing a silent light in the sky at the same time as their neighbors, totally unbeknownst to them, see nothing, but their entire house is shaking. And so it's one of those things where whatever is up there almost seems to be toying with the people that are observing it or feeling it. So, you know, I talked about some of that stuff. The film itself showed really well. Technically, it was fine, and I think everybody liked the film. I'm just not sure everybody liked some of my answers after the film, but that's okay.
The crowd were mostly what? Seriously interested? Or were they what we would call tinfoil hat wearers?
It's funny you should mention that. They had a tinfoil hat making contest, which Brittany entered. And in fact, I thought it was great because she stuck a postcard of the Retro UFO thing on the front of the hat, which is crass commercialism and 110% suck-uppingness. As a filmmaker, I was like, yeah, you've got a very long career in the media entertainment industry. But she didn't win.
No, I didn't think she would. Probably it was the suck-up-ness factor.
They're more into peace, love, and free energy or something down there.
Groovy, yes.
So crass commercialism didn't work. But Zorgrot was there. For your listeners who don't know who Zorgrot is, he's my alien explorer friend from a planet that I still can't name because of security. He made a little tinfoil hat, too. I took him up with me when I was giving my presentation. I'm not sure. There were a couple of people in the audience that I think didn't get the joke or didn't appreciate the joke when I referred to him as an actual alien finally visiting the Integratron. Most of the crowd, I think, was pretty serious. The speakers were, for the most part, with maybe one or two exceptions, all serious, even if you disagreed with them. Everybody I talked to, with the possible exception of the guy who spent 30 minutes trying to convince me that there were Nazi bases under the Antarctic where alien technology was being used, even today, with the exception of him, everybody else took it reasonably seriously.
Now, did his tinfoil hat win?
No, he wasn't using a tinfoil hat. He had a tie-dye T-shirt and said, dude, every five words. It's like, there are Nazis, dude. Antarctic ice with the penguins, dude. And I'd be like, dude. So, yeah, that'll be my next film. He tried to convince me to make that my next film, and I said, well, I don't know, maybe not.
Seven Wonders of the UFO World is your next movie, right?
Well, if I ever get that stuff finished on the column back home, there's no question the Integratron would be, and Giant Rock, there's kind of a matching set, would be on any list of the Seven Wonders of the UFO World. But I would like to do something like that. I am actually trying to develop a project where we could do kind of a travelogue of just, if you're a UFO, I know folks in ufology hate this term, but enthusiast or buff, and I mean that in a good way, or have an interest in the subject, here's places you can plan your travel itinerary on and go see. Like, you can actually walk the Rendlesham Forest and the UFO Trail and camp next to the forest so that at night you can walk the trail and experience maybe some of what Colonel Halt and his men experienced back in 1980. Because Rendlesham's a spooky place anyway.
It has been for literally hundreds of years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, everything, it's not just UFOs. And actually, I talked about this at Retro UFO for a few minutes, about Rendlesham in particular, and I said, look, a lot of these cases, and not necessarily the ones in my film, but a lot of cases just in general, you'll find happen in places that have had a fairly long history of weird and spooky things going on that predate sort of the 1947 modern UFO era. And Rendlesham is certainly one of those places. And Nick Redfern has written about that and certainly can talk about it better than I can. But everything from devil dogs to ghosts, you name it. As you would know, Errol, the United Kingdom is a spooky place in general.
Very weird, yes.
A lot of myths, a lot of legends that certainly predate UFOs. So if UFOs were landing someplace in the United Kingdom, it's probably natural that they would just by accident land in a place that, oh, by the way, there used to be a dragon here, really. But as Jacques Vallée and others have pointed out, maybe there's some sort of connection between the modern UFO era and what we perceive to be UFOs and these previous stories. There might be something that ties it all in. And Greg spoke a bit about that in his presentation at Retro UFO, which was about all the various theories behind the UFO phenomenon. So not just aliens, folks, it could be, and then here's seven other things it could be, including Mac Tonies was there.
Oh.
Not in person, because we were too cheap to fly him out. But Greg played a clip of him talking about the crypto-terrestrial thing for about 3 or 4 minutes that I had done in an interview with Mac about a year and a half ago. So Mac was there not just in spirit, but he was actually talking to the audience, which gave me a great idea for how to do a conference and not lose money. I'll just pre-record everybody and then stick a photo up of them as I play an hour and a half of them talking. Actually, I was thinking if I pump pure oxygen in like they do in Vegas in the casinos, people might get so loopy they wouldn't even notice that the speakers aren't actually there. So I could probably still charge about 70 or 80 bucks a day. And, well, this is probably an idea that maybe some of our exopolitics friends, I shouldn't say because they'll probably go and do it. So perhaps we've said enough.
You weren't just swanning around this past couple of weeks down in the southern part of the States. You were actually down there shooting stuff too, right?
No, I wish. Actually, I was just swanning around.
Really? Boy, and they said people in the UFO world don't make money.
Yeah, go figure. I had some business to do in Los Angeles too, film-related business, some of which relates to UFOs and some of which doesn't. I have a feature film that I'll be shooting in the fall. But also I have a series of docs that I'll be doing with an American company that is totally related to the UFO phenomenon. And I think I'm slated to do three this fall and early winter, three new UFO-related docs. the total number is going to be somewhere around 9 to 12, depending on footage and certain things, over the next probably 2 years. On a raft of subjects, everything from the history of Soviet UFOs to cattle mutilations to Area 51. I think over the next 2 or 3 years, I'll be covering just about every subject in the UFO universe that I haven't covered already.
You say stock footage. Does that mean that you're not going to be shooting any original footage? You're going to be relying on what's being gathered in various archives?
No, most of it's footage that was shot, and I can't say just yet, but by a private source and a very good, solid, reputable entertainment industry private source, let's say that.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be shooting new footage, mostly framing segments and some new interview footage, but most of my job will be writing it, assembling it, putting it all together, and creating it, but most of the footage already exists. I wish I was shooting a ton of new footage because it would mean that I'd get to travel here, there, and everywhere, to quote the Beatles. But I'm probably just going to get to travel here and there as opposed to everywhere. But we're also working on other projects up in Canada, which I hope to get off the ground sometime in the fall with new production partners, actually, that do involve UFOs as well. As well as cryptozoology, which I'm going to try and branch out into that. We've got projects on that. Ghosts. Yeah, ghosts. So all sorts of stuff cooking. A lot of stuff already signed. Well, signed, sealed, but not delivered yet. And other stuff percolating underneath. So yeah, we should be pretty busy. And for those folks that like my work in the paranormal but don't like me, well, you'll get a whole heaping dose of both over the next 2 years. So you'll just have to decide whether one counterbalances the other.
I think, fortunately, there are not a sufficient number of people who don't agree with your points of view, and there will be a much larger number who will be most interested in the documentaries that you're going to be producing in the next couple of years.
Yeah, well, thanks. I'm actually, the one I'm looking forward to seeing is your friend David Cherniak's film, which I don't know if it's out yet or not. But
no, it's running on History Channel here in Canada in the fall, and then once it's had its runs, it'll be available on DVD.
Oh, good. Well, I get the History Channel.
It's good.
Yeah, you were telling me when we talked the other day.
And plus, he has shot so much footage. He did so many interviews for the project that there's probably 4 or 5 other DVDs that will be included in the DVD package.
Oh, well, I hate to hear that because I can't possibly compete, but no, that's good. He's one of Canada's best filmmakers, just in general. So anytime somebody is as far up the food chain as Cherniak decides to turn his attention to a subject, it's worth looking at, even if it's a subject you're not interested in anyway.
I don't know whether you know this or not, but David Cherniak, when he was producing Man Alive for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, was the first documentarian to bring together David Jacobs and Bud Hopkins and John Mack and a whole bunch of abductees for one of the Man Alive programs.
No, I did not know
that. Oh, yeah, David has been into UFOs for a very long time.
Oh, well, sometime, hopefully I'll get a chance to meet him. I could certainly learn a lot from a guy like Cherniak. Now, speaking of Jacobs and Hopkins, I can't let the opportunity go. Now, see, people out there will be thinking, Kimmel's going to bash Jacobs and Hopkins. No, no, no. To remind folks to keep an eye on Space, the Imagination Station, my good friend Mike McDonald's film, Intruders, which features Jacobs and Hopkins in the alien abduction enigma, is airing now, I think, on Space. So check your local listings.
I knew it was coming out, but I wasn't sure when.
I'm pretty sure, I'd have to double check with Mike, but I'm pretty sure that it premiered a month or two ago.
Oh, great.
And, it would be in sort of the never-ending reruns on Space.
Well, there's nothing like being in the loop, Errol.
Yeah, well, hey, don't. For all I know, maybe it hasn't aired, but I'm pretty sure it has. I'm pretty sure Mike told me, and I missed it because I was out of town. That's sort of why I know it. I think it was a month ago when I was down here in L.A. again. Check the Space listings at spacecast.com, everyone. I saw the rough cut. It's a good film, regardless of what you think about the alien abduction thing one way or another. It's a film that's, like all of Mike's films, that is worth seeing.
I'm at the website now, and I'm going to key in Intruders in the search and see what that pops.
On the Space website?
Yeah.
Oh, it'll probably pop up to an automatic link to Battlestar Galactica. Everything goes to Battlestar Galactica.
Intruders, let's see. Spacecast Eureka. Returned 2 results, neither of which is what we're looking for.
Yeah, the other site to look at might be Mike's company site, roadhousefilms.ca. But if you type in Mike McDonald, M-A-C, Donald, and Intruders, you'll find it eventually. And if it's not airing, and I think it is, but if it's not airing already, definitely keep an eye out for it. We've talked about Cherniak and now Mike, but it is rare that you see good UFO films or films made about the UFO subject by people like Mike and David Cherniak, who make films about other subjects, who are good filmmakers in and of themselves, as opposed to a UFO filmmaker who just travels around with his handy cam and makes films about nothing other than UFOs. So when serious documentary filmmakers like those guys make films about UFOs, they're always worth watching if you're interested in the subject.
I've seen a couple of Mike McDonald's documentaries on UFOs. Hell, I've even been in one or two of them. And I had Mike McDonald in to CFRB when I was doing the broadcast version of the show.
He mentioned that. I think the key is when you're talking to somebody who's making a UFO film or even writing a book about UFOs is, okay, well, who have they talked to? And, you know, Mike has relied heavily on Chris Stiles and Don Ledger, certainly with the Shag Harbor material, but he's connected to all of the serious UFO researchers, as I assume David Cherniak was from sort of listening to your traveling road broadcasts. They said, oh, here, I'm visiting so-and-so. Oh, okay, good, good, good. And that's what I do, too. Everyone from Brad Sparks to Dick Hall, Kevin Randall, Nick Pope, those guys. When you can talk to those people and then have an opportunity to put them on screen to get their point across, there's no better feeling. If you're interested in the serious study of the UFO phenomenon, it does actually kind of give you a brief moment of pride to say, well, you know what? I think I might be the only filmmaker, for instance, who put Dick Hall in a film, at least within the last 5 or 10 years. So more folks should be reading Hall's work, and they should be listening to what Dick has to say, and then they can agree or disagree with him. There's a lot of these guys out there that I think get lost in the, as Valet would say, signal to noise. And guys like Dick Hall are the signal, and guys like Stephen Greer are the noise. And the problem is, over the last 10 years, the signal has been lost. And there are some of us that are trying to bring the signal back out to the fore again, even as we might disagree sometimes with what the signal may be saying.
It's really unfortunate that Dick Hall declined to be in David Cherniak's documentary. I think he may regret that one day when he sees what David has produced. I understand him getting pissed off with media and refusing to do things anymore, but unfortunately he didn't heed the words of advice from various people about being in David's doc.
Well, I was lucky to get him, and I think the only reason he agreed to be in my film was he knew me from the UFO updates list, actually, and we had corresponded, and he'd seen the Stan Friedman film I did, and he said, okay, Kimball will treat the subject seriously, so I'm not going to be made a fool of. And that, I think, was the only reason he agreed to do mine. Everybody else, as you say, he doesn't do films anymore. He hasn't been well, so there might have been that as well.
There was probably a certain amount of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did Cherniak interview Brad Sparks?
They missed each other for some reason.
Oh, that's too bad. Every time my film airs, people say, who's that Brad Sparks guy?
Yeah, well, they obviously don't read Project 1947 or the UFO updates list.
No.
Then they would know.
And whenever I do interviews, and here I am doing another one, I always say, look, over the last 30 years, the best researcher into the UFO phenomenon has been Brad Sparks. In terms of just digging information out, a point I think I made at Retro UFO, too. Because somebody, I think, actually asked me, who's this Brad Sparks guy? And I went, well, here's who he is. There was a lady in the audience who asked me, what's the Condon Report? And part of me, you know, part of my reaction, well, especially as I just spent 10 minutes explaining what the Condon Report was, so it's like, were you asleep? But the other part was, look, you're at a UFO conference and you don't know what the Condon Report is. How can you talk seriously about UFOs if you haven't even heard the term Condon Report? It's crazy. But that part of me lost out to the good part of me that said, oh, you know what? Not everybody, like 99.9% of the population, knows what the Condon Report is. So one baby step at a time, one person at a time. Let's explain it to them and also explain what it means. But at least she asked. A lot of people would just listen to me and then go, I don't care what he's talking about, Condon Schmondon. I'm going to go out and commune with the Space Brothers. But she asked, so good for her.
And perhaps the listener who doesn't know what the Condon Report is all about, go to the UFO Updates Archive. You have access with your username and password, and do a search on Condon Report. You'll be amazed what comes up.
Or read this current issue of Stuart Miller's wonderful magazine, Alien Worlds.
Oh, of course, yes, yes.
Where I write a regular column.
Yes.
This month it's the Condon Effect and Roswellism. So you can get the gist of the Condon Report there. And you'll be talking in just a minute, I guess, with Brittany Babikayoff, another columnist for Alien Worlds magazine.
The discovery of yours, or did somebody else point her in your direction?
No, she was this young researcher, person with interest in UFOs out in British Columbia, who just emailed me out of the blue, me and a few other researchers, I guess. I always respond, something Stan Friedman taught me, always respond, even if it's just a line. She asked intelligent questions. What should I be looking for? What should I read? So I said, well, read Valet, read Hynek. Here's Jim McDonald. Here's three links to his papers. Dick Hall's UFO evidence, Jerry Clark. Then we just started corresponding after that by email and sent her Stewart's way and said, look, the guy's looking for columnists. And we're always nattering on, too, about young people. All of us are.
Yeah.
And so here was one who actually had an interest and who was intelligent and fit all the criteria that we were looking for. If you need somebody to give the youth perspective on the UFO phenomenon, here's somebody. So she wrote the column for Stewart, and Stewart said, wow, this is great. And so he published it, and now he's going to keep publishing her as long as his magazine's going, I guess.
Oh, good.
As far as I know, he's the only UFO-related magazine out there that actually has somebody under the age of 40 writing for him. So that kudos to Stewart, who's a bright guy, even if he'll never admit it.
Can I speak with Brittany for a few moments?
You may indeed. In fact, I did all of that just to help you with the segue.
Well, so, thank you.
Because I'm an old radio guy myself, so.
You're wonderful with it.
Emphasis on old. All right, I'll hand you over to Brittany. Brittany, here is Errol Brusnap.
Hello, Errol. How are you?
I am well, Brittany, and good to have you on the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
How come you got intrigued enough by the UFO thing to get in touch with Paul Kimball?
It's actually always just sort of been an interest, not just UFOs, but pretty much anything paranormal. There's actually one time my mom was getting her tattoo done. The tattoo artist that was doing it was telling us his encounter with a UFO. And I was about 10 or so at the time, but that really sparked my interest. I just figured UFOs were like Santa Claus and like Easter Bunny, like any kid's going to think it's just make-believe. When I found out that, oh, there's a possibility that, you know, it's something more, that got me even more interested. And I've always sort of sought to understand, and I'm always looking to understand everything, and this just really sparked my interest, so.
Solve the mysteries.
Yeah, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
And as time went on, it's continued, but I'm a music student, so I was distracted with that, which is a good thing. I love to play, I love to sing, and so on the side of that, I just kind of did my own little research and then found Paul, and he was kind enough to reply. A few others did too, but he gave me the most to work with and the most information. And then after that, we just sort of, it led me here. It was great.
So you spent a year or two cramming?
Yeah, a lot of cramming, I guess. It was hard while going to school, especially for something in a totally unrelated topic. But it was great.
Have any members of your family or any of your friends had any UFO-related experiences?
No, actually. I've talked to a few back in Nelson, where I was going to college. And there were a few that have claimed to see UFOs, but they didn't like to talk about it. And that was one thing I mentioned in my article in Alien Worlds. That proved to me a lot of things. Kids are afraid to speak because they're afraid to be judged and criticized. And so I mentioned that. That's a big part of it.
And with the older folk, too, it's been like that throughout the last 50 years. Is a lot of people just don't want to talk about it because they'll get labeled as loonies.
It shouldn't be that way.
Well, it's up to you, my dear, to go out there.
I'm working on it, all right?
Change it. Damn it, change it.
But no, I haven't had any encounters myself so far.
How did you feel about the conference that you were just at with Paul and Greg?
Oh, it was great. Actually, I was surprised about how much was spoken about, not just UFOs, but a lot of paranormal subjects, even like higher consciousness and spiritual things, and which all interest me as well. So the whole time there, I'm just taking notes down like mad and, and you know, just in total awe of all these people. I felt so at home, too, which is great. I felt comfortable. And Paul Kimball and Greg Bishop and Nick Redfern, they're all such great guys. I felt completely at ease. Totally in place, and it went in every way I expected. I didn't even really try to expect anything so as not to be disappointed, but there was no chance of that. It was absolutely wonderful.
I tell you what I found interesting over the years being involved with ufology. publicly, most UFO researchers will poo-poo the idea that all the things that we call paranormal are interrelated, and UFOs fit in there too.
Right.
But when you talk to them privately, a lot of them will fess up and say, well, you know, I didn't used to believe that it was all interconnected, but now it seems to be, it is. A lot of UFO researchers tend to be blinkered. They won't see anything out of the corner of their eyes.
Tunnel vision sort of thing.
Yeah, but gradually some of them are coming around, and that's really interesting too, because it opens them up to a much broader horizon, in much the same way as your horizon already is broadened, and you're open to all kinds of things, and that's really a good way to start out in this field.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm trying to stay that way. I mean, Paul's taught me that's the best way to go about it.
Yeah, and I want to tell you that I did read your column. Stuart kindly sends me a copy of the magazine, and I liked what you wrote.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, and thank you for writing it. And who knows what's going to happen to Brittany Babiakoff in the next couple of years, as far as this field is concerned.
I did ask Stuart if I could do a review article on RetroCon, and he said that he'd allow that, so I was thrilled, and I can't wait to go home now, even though I don't want to leave L.A. The guys know it. I'm talking about moving here. But no, I am looking forward to going home and reading all the books that they've given me and watching all the DVDs that I got at RetroCon and then writing a really good article out of this, I hope.
Well, I look forward to reading it, Brittany, and look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Yeah, same here. Well, it was nice talking to you.
And enjoy the remainder of the time there. Are you going back to school or are you through now?
I'm done with school for now. I just want to focus on writing, saving up, and then hopefully making my way down here to L.A. permanently.
Well, I wish you luck with that.
Thank you very much.
Good talking with you.
Good to you. And did you want to speak with Greg?
Yeah, I suppose I should. It's his house.
Okay. Here he is.
Okay.
Thanks, Daryl.
Bye.
Hey, Errol.
Hey, Greg.
Hi. No questions left now, huh?
Oh, no, lots of questions left.
I'm going last. I'm the headliner.
Yeah. So I asked Paul Kimball about the meaning of the Integratron and who built it and why it was built, and he suggested that you would probably be the person to answer that question because you know more about it.
When he was answering the question, he looked over, and I was shaking my head, nodding my head, and then he finally said, oh, forget it. I'll just wait till Greg. It was actually built by George Van Tassel, a contactee, American UFO contactee from the 1950s. He died in 1977, having not finished the Integratron, which is not a building. It looks like an observatory, like some kind of astronomical observatory. It was built actually as a giant electrostatic generator that was supposed to allow people to just walk through it and lengthen your life. Because he said the Space Brothers told him not only to build this machine, but if he did build it, people could lengthen their lives and they wouldn't have to reincarnate and all that stuff. They could get it right in one lifetime if only they had the Integratron. So because of these instructions, he started getting donations from people over many years. It took him, I think he started building it, I believe, in 1955 or 56. Maybe a little bit later, and like I said, it was unfinished as of his death in 1977. He also published a newsletter from his cosmic school called the College of Universal Wisdom. And from all these little checks and things that came in from people, he would slowly build this building. And amazingly enough, since it doesn't use any metal fasteners, it was all done with fitting wood together and glue, it's still standing, and it's very solid, and it probably needs a little bit of work to restore it to its former glory, and then maybe even some more money, which would be nice to actually use Van Tassel's plans and instructions and finish it. I don't know what it would do or if it would do any good or if it would even work. I think it'd be amazing to have the thing out there in the desert with part of the building spinning around and sparks shooting out of it and everything. If I had the money, I'd put the money in and just have the thing finished.
How close is it to Giant Rock?
About 2 miles from Giant Rock, there's a dirt road that goes up to Giant Rock, which is owned by the Bureau of Land Management, and the land on the Integratron, obviously at this point that somebody owns it, is privately owned.
Was it a really big piece of Giant Rock that came off?
Yeah, about a fifth of it broke off, and fell on the ground. There were actually people out there camping when it happened, about, you know, a couple hundred feet away from
Whoa.
It.
Whoa.
Happened at 8 in the morning, I think. It happened about 6 years ago or something like that, 6 or 7 years ago. I actually wrote up a story about it for 40 and Times, and I went out and talked to some people out there and the local news reporter who had written the story and found out about it that way. And there were two schools of thought. One was it broke apart because Great Spirit, if you're an American Indian follower, or the Space Brothers, if you're a UFO follower, or Mother Earth, if you're a New Age follower, caused the thing to break off. Or, on the other hand, you can talk to the people that work out there and said there was a big crack in it. It was just getting bigger every year, and it just finally broke off. The crack had been there for a long time, and right underneath where the crack was a huge burnt spot on the rock because people kept building bonfires there. And so in the winter, it would get maybe a little water or ice in it, and that would open it up, and then people would heat it from underneath, and that would make it expand, and finally it just couldn't take it anymore and cracked.
Well, that's too bad.
It's some multi-ton piece of the rock.
Yeah, it's huge. Did it fall over or did it stay upright? I'm trying to remember because I remember
it was kind of a bottom heavy after it broke off, so it actually broke off and you could see the inside of the rock, which is very bright white. And of course, anything that happens like that where there's a nice blank canvas, it got graffiti on it immediately, like within a day. When I went out there, it was about a week after it had broke off. There was so much graffiti on it that you could see it coming up the road for a mile down the road.
Well, it'll weather away, and once all the graffiti writers have disappeared off the planet, then it'll just go back to its natural state again.
People actually go out there from the Historical Society and paint over and sandblast it, which isn't as pretty as it used to be, but at least it covers up most of the graffiti, and then they just wait for it to get graffitied up again, then they come back out and do it again, but in between, it's actually looks pretty decent.
Mm-hmm. Obviously not your first or second or third trip out there.
No, I've been going out there for probably 10 or 15 years and just watching the place kind of deteriorate as off-road vehicles and motorcycle dirt bike riders discovered the area and go there every weekend now. Used to be I'd go out there and it was completely deserted all the time.
Mm.
And it was kind of peaceful and nice. Actually, the Giant Rock Cafe, which is a little restaurant that George Van Tassel and his wife ran, used to be right next to Giant Rock. All that was left when I first went out there was the floor. It was a tile floor.
Mm.
And as the years wore on and more people came out there on motorcycles and stuff, they would run over the floor, and now it's been pulverized and it's gone, which is unfortunate. So I was thinking, could I build a little wall around this or something, or put rocks around it? But it wouldn't have worked, because if somebody wants to destroy something, they're pretty single-minded about it. I did take pieces of the floor, though, as they broke off and took them home with me. I've got two or three giant plastic bags full of floor tiles from the Giant Rock Cafe sitting in my garage.
Ooh, can we expect to see any of those on eBay at any time soon?
I don't think I want to sell them because I feel this weird, even though I don't really believe anything they ever said, at least most of it, I feel this connection to the contactees in that era. I mean, I wasn't even alive then, but I would feel like I'm doing something sacrilegious to sell pieces of that history. So what I was going to do, actually, is when I get a house, is pour some concrete or something out in my backyard and make a little patio out of all those tiles from the Giant Rock Cafe.
That's almost as good as selling them.
I suppose, but, you know, I'm not making money off it.
No.
What else am I going to do with them? Actually, every time I go out there, it's been run over so much that the pieces get smaller and smaller and smaller. So they're being turned into dust. It's like, you know, archaeology or something. If there's something out there in the wilderness and it's being ruined, do you let it be ruined if it has some historical significance, or do you take it somewhere and preserve it and let people see it? I don't know. There's no central UFO museum. I suppose if the Roswell Museum or something wants a piece of the Giant Rock Cafe tile floor, I'll send them one, but I don't think anybody really cares that much.
Yeah, it's too bad. To a certain extent, I can understand the poo-pooing of the contactee movement, but at the same time, it is a part of ufological history anyway.
I think it's an important part of the history, and people that are very, let's solve this problem, we're not going to get any respect from the scientific community or the larger community unless we forget about this part of things and concentrate on the science in solving this problem, that they have a very low opinion of the contactees. To me, it's like making fun of somebody's belief system. I may not agree with them, but if they're sincere about it and don't shove it down my throat or try to insert themselves in government and make me live the way they want to live, as long as that's not happening, I've perfectly fine with it. And since it's connected to UFOs, obviously I'm sympathetic and attracted to it. As a cultural phenomenon and also as a psychological phenomenon, there's things there that people haven't looked at, I think, within the contactee mythos and the way they process their information and what they said about people coming from outer space that I think might be valuable still in the study of UFOs, because as I've talked about and Paul has and other people, a lot of what's going on in the UFO subject is how we perceive it and how that's changed, actually. People don't think it's changed, but it's especially with regards to aliens or whatever they are that are associated with UFOs, that's changed radically over the last even 50 years.
Yeah, that's if you're into or subscribed to the extraterrestrial hypothesis.
Well, even if you're not, actually. Mm-hmm. That was part of my talk at the Integratron there, was different theories about UFOs and aliens and where they might come from, separate and apart from the ETH, extraterrestrial hypothesis, which I did spend 20 minutes describing just so people knew what it was and all the pluses and minuses of it. But the point was that people have seen so many different UFOs and so many different kinds of aliens or non-humans, as I call them, that either there's hundreds and hundreds of civilizations visiting us or there's some sort of interaction between whatever that is out there, outside of our brains and our consciousness, and the way we perceive it. I tend to think it's probably more of the latter, where we put our own meaning and our own appearance and whatever on what we see. Otherwise, why so many different shapes of UFOs and why so many different types of creatures, especially, and Valet pointed this out, culturally they seem to break down along cultural lines. Hairy dwarves in South America and humanoids in the United States and midgets with diving suit looking things on in France. And what's going on here? I think it has more to do with perception of something than it does with a reality of, if you put this in front of 40 different people from different areas, would they all see the same thing? And I tend to think not. Even if five people see a murder, there's going to be differences in what they talk about. But the thing is, they're all going to say, this guy came at the other guy, or he had a knife, or he didn't have a knife. When you start talking about something people have no reference for, I think the opinions would begin to diverge. Not everybody sees a weird thing stepping out of a metallic disc out in the middle of nowhere or in the woods or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I would tend to think that if that thing appeared before three or four different people, you'd get three or four widely diverging ideas about what that is, if you get my meaning.
Absolutely. Yes, indeed.
There's no cultural reference for it, really. I mean, there's more now, which is why I think you see more standardization of reports. You've got a box to put it in, so to speak, a mental box to put it in, so that's where it goes.
Talking of boxes, just to completely change the subject for a moment, are you still doing your Radio Mysterioso program?
Yes, I'm still doing it at killradio.org.
Do you do that live, or do you put it in the can and then tidy up?
I think I've only done one show that isn't live. Oh. I like doing the live shows because there's a different energy to them.
Well, this is true, too. And I always like live radio because I would go into the station and 2 hours or 3 hours later I would leave and it would be done, unlike what we're doing now, where it hangs around for at least a week or so while I organize and tidy, you know?
Exactly. And probably, like me, you're very lazy about it. It's like, I'd rather just be done with it. You know, I don't want to have to sit around and edit it and mess with it and all that. And whatever happens during the show happens during the show. And a lot of things, I think, have happened during my show that wouldn't have if I'd pre-recorded it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll get on a thread about something. And, you know, we've got 2 hours, so no commercials or anything. So we can say and do and explore whatever we want.
I always had news and commercials. Is somebody checking their mail at your end of things?
No.
Periodically, your voice goes into a burble that suggests a 2.4 megahertz telephone being interfered with a Wi-Fi.
Somebody was checking their mail. If that's coming through on the phone here, it should stop now. I'm sorry about that.
No, that's okay.
I never noticed it. I guess you only hear it on your end because you're coming through loud and clear.
That's right. If you're on a cordless phone and it's on 2.4, which is the same as the computer Wi-Fi system, then you get that funny burbling sounds. It almost sounds as if the person at the other end is talking to you from the bottom of a goldfish bowl.
Well, we've stopped using it now. I hope that was only happening during my talking.
Well, Greg Bishop, thank you, sir. It has been, as always, interesting talking with you. I will put links up to Radio Mysterioso and Into the Mystic, the blog that you and Nick Redfern and one other person whose name didn't stick when I looked.
Well, it's called UFO Mystic.
UFO Mystic.
Wasn't my idea. It was the guy that owns the site. The other guy was Craig Woolheater, who's one of the people on behind the scenes on Crypto Mundo and UFO Mystic. Those two blog sites are run by the same company.
Aha.
One time I did post for about 3 or 4 days, and he panicked and stuck his name on there and decided he would start posting, but he hasn't done so since then because I've kept up my end of the deal.
No wonder I didn't recognize the name.
Yeah, what he did was he put up a couple of links to videos, and immediately a bunch of people came on and said, these things look like crap. They don't tell us anything. He backed off after that.
Yeah.
It'd be like me posting about the Orang Pendek or something in Sumatra. I know a little bit about it, but not a great deal of detail. And if you've got aficionados on a site like that and you put up something that doesn't address what their concerns are, you find out about it pretty quick.
From more than one or two people.
Yes, exactly. That's why I like the updates list, because everybody on there seems to know exactly what they're talking about. And if there's anything like peer review in ufology, UFO Updates provides it. However that manifests.
Yes. Or not.
Or not, yeah.
Well, sir, again, thank you. And my thanks to Brittany and to Paul Kimball. And look forward to talking to you all again at some not-too-distant point in the future.
Oh, I do, too, and so do they. They're both vigorously nodding their heads. Nod your heads. There they go.
Nod. Bye, Greg.
Bye. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Right. Bye.
One of the things I enjoy about having Alfred Lemberg on the program is, first of all, we tell you what we're going to tell you, and then we tell you stuff, and then Alfred Lemberg tells us what we've been told, which is always handy to drive points home just in case you missed it. And this program is no exception, because joining us on the line from his home down there in Enterprise, Alabama, is Alfred Lemberg.
You're only saying all of that because it's true.
Isn't that what this program is all about?
Yes, truth. Truth in the Canadian American way.
And the worldwide way.
Yes.
We mustn't exclude people who listen to this all over the planet.
Killer show, Burner.
Yes, I had a really good time with Furry and with Paul Kimball and with newcomer Brittany Babakayoff and Greg Bishop. Learned some interesting things from Greg this time.
He's one of those guys that is able to communicate that sincerity that you're always looking for as an audience member, somebody that you can listen to that's not sounding too pompous and filled with themselves. Really, it was a killer program all the way around. It was good to hear our Mr. Kimball come on and kind of front what has come to be known, I understand, as the evil triumvirate of Kimball, Bishop, and McTonies.
I don't know who's labeled them that.
Oh, really? Oh, well, I can tell you exactly who. One Rich Reynolds. We can always count on Rich to point out the obvious failings of the people around him, can't we?
Who?
Rich Reynolds.
Rich Reynolds really doesn't count for very much, perhaps only in his own mind and the minds of his followers, unless there are people who secretly go over there and read what he has to say at his blog. It doesn't count for anything as far as the field is concerned.
No, and it really doesn't, except for the fact that he is pretty articulate and convincing naysayer that is effective for obfuscating issues like your exopolitical bunch to a large degree.
But enough file time on Rich Reynolds, unless you had more to add.
No. That was just interesting that the evil triumvirate was in evidence and they lurked. It was an opportunity to mention McTonies. With regard to Paul Kimball, rising star, we're talking about some really serious interest with him vis-a-vis his new film opportunities about UFOs, cattle mutilations, Area 51, Soviet UFOs. Huh?
Yeah, he's grabbed himself a nice chunk of the market.
Yeah, a good niche, and I'm really looking forward to his subsequent programs being at least as far-reaching and as useful and informational as Best Evidence is turning out to be.
Mm-hmm.
His discussion about where he'd been over the period that he was talking about, the retro conference there, it's interesting that Paul Kimball was able to point out the real point of that conference, though, which was that it was an intellectual throwback to the contactee movement of the 1950s.
I think that was the whole point of having it at the Integratron.
Right, and as hot as it was still figuratively cool over there.
I think it's wonderful that it's still there and a part of UFO history. As Kimball said, like it or not, it is, and I'm really pleased that things are still going on there. One day I would like to go down and take a look around, and maybe even find a piece of tile from the old cafe there.
Oh, exactly, too. I was kind of lusting for a piece myself when he brought it up.
Well, perhaps Greg Bishop will send us both a piece.
Hey, that'd be nice.
It would go along with my bottle of white sand and my envelope with the United States Postal Service commemorating 50 years of Roswell that we picked up when we were down in Roswell. Interesting memorabilia.
True. I wonder, too, what kind of souvenirs they were able to get from the Integratron in the Giant Rock area.
The potential souvenir, I guess, is, as was said in the interview, was the fact that it's incomplete, and perhaps one day they will manage to raise the money to complete the plans and then see what it does.
Yeah, a very peculiar building, too, because while the interior has to have no metal in it at all and was built only of wood and wood pegging and stuff, and kind of a testament to architecture that it's still standing at all, the way I figure it, on the outside is supposed to be some kind of rotating metal affair, which is able to focus these waves.
Yeah.
I did rankle a little bit with Paul when he started talking about American cultural history, you know, for the area and the contacting movement, where we're all kind of painted as a bunch of mouth-breathing losers, just every bit earning the appellation of being misleading, misled, or mentally ill. It may very well be that the contactee movement is symptomatic of what America's cultural history could be, as Paul Kimball did relate in his discussion a little bit. But I rankle about it because most of society is thinking those contactee people were pretty much painted as mouth-breathing losers and persons just every bit earning that old appellation that UFOs used to get from all the learned individuals, that if we're talking about UFOs, we're talking about the misleading, we're talking about the misled, or we're talking about the mentally ill. So that's why I kind of rankled a little bit at it being America's cultural history. I don't think it was America's cultural history so much as kind of like a world cultural history, not strictly American.
Yeah.
Look at Adamski. Adamski wasn't really an American. There's Billy Meyer. He's not an American. I think it's a world cultural phenomenon.
Yeah, polluters of the ufological waters is the way to put it.
But when you say pollution of the waters, again, a lot of those people have something at the core of their experience that maybe they tried to confabulate or expand upon or try to relive later. But Bishop made that point later on when he was talking about how he felt he had a strong connection for the 1950s contactees. And I think he had that feeling because even if those people did perform a bad interpretation on something they experienced it nonetheless. So this bad interpretation of what was an aggregate weirdness still reflects that weirdness. So you have to respect that. And I think that's what Greg Bishop was doing and thinking about when he indicated that he had a little affection for these people. George Williamson, George King, George Adamski, all those guys named George.
Three guys named George, yeah. And a plug for Wendy Connor's disc, if you haven't picked yourself up a copy or ordered yourself a copy. The Three Guys Named George is a fascinating look at the contactee movement of the 50s.
Right. And speaking of Wendy, I've got virtually all of her discs on an iPod, and I end up listening to something that she's collected and put on disc for us virtually every day. Just good stuff, you know. Yeah. Driving in the car to the store, boom, you got reality hitting you right in the face.
Wendy Connors Faded Discs, and that's fadeddiscs.com.
Yes. Back to the retro conference and the tinfoil hat competition that Paul was talking about. I got to tell you that that kind of, in equal parts, ticked me off and delighted me. And it ticked me off because, well, it's a tinfoil freaking hat, okay? You know?
Yeah.
But then, on the other hand, it kind of delighted me because I realized that these people were just kind of recapturing for their own use the concept of tinfoil hat. Like, this is a bad example, I know, but it's like gay people taking back the word queer for their own.
Mm-hmm.
and getting rid of the stigma that way. So that's why it kind of delighted me, I think.
Yeah. And there was some interesting tinfoil hat, as evidenced by the pictures at Paul Kimball's blog.
Right.
If the listener would like to take a look at those, then the link is in the program listing.
Yes, apparently Miss Babakayoff had an entry that pandered to the aspects of the conference or something.
It wasn't really a true tinfoil hat.
But in a kind of a bid to commercialism that nobody appreciated or something.
Yeah, she stuck the conference logo on it.
And that's where Paul Kimball, right there at that point, found an opportunity to sneer at the concepts of peace, love, and free energy. I thought, all right, it's peace, love, and free energy, but hey, you don't have to sneer at it. You got to be on board for that. And who in their right mind would be against peace, love, and free energy except someone who is in their right mind? I'm only kidding. Except let me mention this. There's apparently... No, this is not too bad. There's apparently a person down there, he was a conference attendee, perhaps one of the vendors, and was trying to move a book or a DVD or something like that. And he kept calling Paul, dude, every 5 minutes. I just wanted to remind everybody listening that the use of the word dude is not entirely repellent. We shouldn't discount, deride, distort, demean, denounce, or otherwise degrade the salutary use of the word dude.
Right on, dude.
It is one of my favorite words of fellowship, and anybody who calls me on the phone and I recognize who they are, that's the first word to hear out of me. Dude!
I have heard it every time I've ever called you.
Yep, every mm-hmm. time. I think I use it basically because I know it pisses off the people that I really want to piss off. Regarding the rich history of ufological occurrence select locations, and I'm talking about all the crazy stuff that for basically hundreds of years has been going on in West Virginia, in the O'Hare Airport area, lately around Stephenville, you know, all of these areas that have this rich ufological history, and we come to Rendlesham, which has a ufological history of some hundreds of years. We're talking devil dogs and ghosts. We're talking dragons at Rendlesham, right? By report and by legend,
yep.
Right? But the concern is, in the dark ages of a hoary old England, what would a dragon breathing fire be but, in the final analysis, a UFO?
This is true, yes.
In accordance with Jacques Vallée is talking about, in accordance with the Bible and their descriptions of wheels within wheels, persons trying to couch in the language that they understand things that are inconceivable to them.
How else would primitive people or unsophisticated people describe what it was that they were seeing?
Right. Fairies, leprechauns,
mm-hmm.
water nixies, beasts bumping in the night, stealing your children. It's rich, 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 unbelievably rich history that actually some use to try to discount the ufological.
Yeah.
Paul Kimball showed that he had a little concern, perhaps, about the new Cherniak UFO documentary being a better film than he had. And I should point out to him that he probably should not despair at all, because the way I kind of hear it and the way I kind of feel about it, and from what I know about Cherniak and the kind of films he produces and what Paul Kimball has, in fact, produced and that I have seen, is that the two films are very likely to complement one another the same way that Nichols and Gazecki's crop circle films complement each other in their right. And in fact, to persons who ask me serious questions about UFOs, I have them first watch Best Evidence, and then I have them watch Out of the Blue, and I can see later on that I'm going to be able to provide a number three punch with Cherniak's DVD. What I'm saying is a 1-2-3 punch of, here it is, folks, you can't walk away from this unaffected.
A perfect 1-2-3 punch.
And aside, something I just thought of rolled in out of the blue, have you ever considered how UFOs kind of provide for their own deniability? If you need to say, oh, that wasn't a UFO, that was a trash can lid, or that was an inverted wedding cake mold, that UFOs provide their own deniability. They make something just weird enough in the sighting of them where they can be discounted if you have to.
Well, that's been true all through history, hasn't it?
Right. How about that new copy of On the Space Channel by Mike McDonald, and it's a film called Intruders?
Yeah.
Do you know anything about that film? Have you seen that film?
I haven't. I remember reading something about it, and then it came and went, and I missed it. And I couldn't find it listed on the Canadian Space Channel.
Description sounded really intriguing.
Well, I think it's going to end up in the States anyway, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. I'll be looking for it in any case. Paul points out quite rightly that when you're at these conferences and people show an interest, you really ought to kind of go out of your way to be nice to them. And I like that. I like that whole attitude. You take time. Somebody writes you an email and you bounce something back to them, you know, even if it just is a little bit. Trying to keep the thread alive, to keep the fabric in a weave. But then he pointed out, quite rightly also, that this person that asked a question what the Condon Report is, how can you be interested in UFOs if you don't know what the Condon Report was? And he's right about that.
Mm-hmm.
Except the only thing I can figure is maybe the asker of that question wanted to hear what Paul really thought the Condon Report was. And I don't think you can question the interest of that person, given that they paid the money to get there. So they're really kind of put paid for that, all right? But the point is, these people who are interested in knowing, they don't know if they know. It's all so crazy. It remains that the Condon debacle was an undeniable illustration that the ufological deck has been stacked against any kind of ufological disclosure from the beginning, and that science was not only disserved, it was betrayed, and society shows itself to be an errant sham. And culture, finally, an enemy. I would also like to tell you at this point that I'm available for children's parties, okay, Errol?
There's no doubt that the Condon Report really, really did do a lot of damage as far as scientific interest in UFOs.
I'm glad Paul was on board with that and wrote that paper exploding the Condon Report for what it was all about. In fact, it's one of the things that started me crediting him after our long kerfuffle. Last thing on Paul Kimball, he noted that he couldn't recall any writer under the age of 40 on any magazine, and that Stuart Miller deserved kudos for being able to get one in Ms. Babakayoff. I have to remind you that there's UFO magazine sports a young man by the name of Sam Wiley from England, who's still in his teens, I believe. And then, of course, there's Jeremy Vaney, who writes for UFO Magazine frequently. He's 35, I think. And then, of course, there's myself. I'm 39. I write for the magazine.
I thought you were younger than that.
I was younger. Yeah, a lot of people take me for being immature.
And then, of course, there's John Greenwald Jr. of the Black Vault.
That's right. I forgot about him. He writes for the magazine, too.
And look at the staggering amount of work he's done at his Black Vault website.
You know, I really am in amazement at that kid, because he was a kid 15 years ago when everybody's watching this little upstart. Who is this young person that thinks they can just arrive on the scene and start, you know, asking questions? Well, I'll tell you who. John Greenwald.
Yeah, that's who.
And he's, boy, filled out nicely, turned into a nice-looking young man, didn't he?
And he's archived all of the MUFON journals. They're all there now at Black Vault as PDFs.
I have to go over there and peruse some of those.
Unfortunately, there's no contents for each of them.
Well, maybe that's coming.
It would be a good project for somebody to volunteer for. Yeah. Download everything and then put up the index for each issue.
Brittany Babakayov. Well, that rolls off the tongue nicely, doesn't it?
Doesn't it?
With regard to young persons and ufology, and a very interesting, her outlook and her take on it seems to be a little bit more inclusive than what some of the persons involved with ufology our age are interested in, more of the nuts and bolts. It seems that she's an indicator that UFOs, for most folks under 30, has a very spiritual aspect to it that they consider important.
And again, as there are blinkered scientists, then we also have blinkered ufologists.
Well, by the same token, that there is this interest of young persons to solve the mystery. And of course, we here on our end would love to solve the mystery ourselves, but I don't think the absolute solution of the mystery is probably the important thing. It's the path en route to it is what's important. I think that's what we're supposed to be on. Besides that, mysteries aren't really sought so much as they're faced. I was interested to note that she told this little story about how she and her mom were downtown getting tattoos.
Yeah, that's typical West Coast Canadian sort of style.
Boy, if I'd lived in a life where I thought my mother and I could have ever gone down to a tattoo parlor and gotten a tattoo, the whole thing just seemed to be an entirely different dimension, perhaps one of youth, where I am of the dimension now of approaching daughtering age. What do you think, Carol?
Please.
Except for the UFOs. The UFOs will keep us young. With regard to Ms. Babakayov and her kind of new inclusiveness, that seems to be a youthful approach to UFOs, that they want to pretty much pack all paranormal things into the same kind of drawer and indicate a relationship that way. And I know that you and I have talked about that before, that ghosts are related to UFOs or related to Bigfoot or related to Nixies, fairies, and
crop circles.
Nixies.
Yeah.
As a final thing on Ms. Babakayov, I am interested to hear that she's really interested in thinking of all of these different paranormal things in concert with one another, like they have some kind of relationship. And I know that you and I have talked about that, that everything is related in this venue. Things that inflame our imagination have this relationship with one another that is, well, very interesting for me, because it seems to connote the fact that all of this paranormal stuff exists to keep us from getting too filled with ourselves and too arrogant and too convinced that we are the jewel in the crown of creation, when it's, in all likelihood, we're probably not.
Taking a look around the planet the way it is at the moment, I don't think so.
But she seems like a really welcome addition, and I'm really looking forward to reading some of her stuff as soon as it gets made available to me. Hint, 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 hint. You hearing that, Stuart? Bishop talked quite a bit about the Integratron, a very interesting subject, despite the fact that all accounts have George Van Tassel, the proponent of that thing, had him pretty much as the known hoodwinker, and into some really dodgy things with regard to Space Brothers and get your life right in one lifetime, some kind of cosmic quick fix that Bishop was referencing, and his alleged College of Universal Wisdom and all of that. And just kind of an indicator to me that, again, George Van Tassel was onto something, into something, had an encounter with something that I think he's just another one of those folks that confabulated into idiocy, perhaps, the way it could be argued that Meyer did, Adamski did, George Williamson did, George King did, you know, all of those guys.
Van Tassel was certainly one of them.
Now, Giant Rock is the Giant Rock and probably dumped there by some glacier long, long ago. I think the evidence of the Giant Rock is a kind of sketchy on its provenance. The breakoff of Giant Rock is very intriguing, and forgetting what any of the Space Brothers or the Crystal Squeezers would be saying about it, and I say that with all respect to Space Brothers and Crystal Squeezers, okay? But seriously, I think what's really key there are the Indian legends with regard to a piece of Giant Rock breaking off like that, or giant rock being rent asunder, some kind of Indian legend, some kind of specialness about that rock, and that when it broke, it would be indicative of something else happening, along the same lines as the white buffalo, the legend of the blue star, with regard to some kind of prophecy.
And what was the prophecy?
They're very nebulous about what the exact prophecy was, but it's along the lines of what is allegedly going to happen in 2012, and there is going to be some kind of new order or some kind of cataclysm, the rock breaking off and the blue star and the white buffalo and all of these things about 2012 and all this peculiarity. Maybe we're just succumbing to another millennialism as this thing approaches.
Hmm.
We were talking earlier about Meyer and Adamski and Williamson and King and all those people. Regarding this politically correct tendency that I think that we're developing to spread the ufological focus between UFOs and UAPs, we discussed briefly what the differences between those could be. One you can hold in your hand as a real object, and the other one doesn't have to be anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so maybe we don't want to offend folks who are too dismissive of the extraterrestrial hypothesis or too accepting of the extraterrestrial hypothesis, but it remains. Whatever it is, if it's the extra-biological, the extra-dimensional, the extra-temporal, the archaeo-terrestrial, which is a new one I heard over the weekend, and the crypto-terrestrial that Mac Tonies makes famous, all of that is moot. It doesn't matter. The other remains, and that's what all of those things we're talking about. This other, this intransigent, won't-go-away, very insinuating and not-so-insular, perhaps, other, this other thing, this thing that doesn't pay taxes or is beholden to George Walker Bush.
And on the subject of UFOs and UAPs, I think it was Don Ledger who has brought it up on this program more than twice or three times, is that it was Dr. Richard Haynes at NARCAP who wanted to encourage pilots and air traffic controllers to come forward and tell their stories without actually using the term UFO and unidentified aerial phenomena. Haynes thought would encourage said pilots, air traffic controllers to come forward and report at their website.
And that's certainly a good point, and I applaud that. The only thing is, it's the embarrassment of the term UFO that is really at issue, and I think that embarrassment is very unfairly deserved and imposed upon the UFO more than it bringing it on itself. Bishop was talking about them changing shape, their morphology. There seems to be this difference in types that are reported, and his contention was either these persons who are witnessing these alien craft and alien beings, either their perception is off or that there actually are many of these different alien types. And I got to thinking about what he was saying, and Bishop was indicating that maybe there's too much perception and too little reality in this subject of UFOs. And this is kind of forgetting, I think, what Freud and Einstein and Heisenberg and all those people were talking about, that these legendary names gave every indication that perception is the reality by virtue of it having so much potential to change reality. And that being the case, is there not a little more reality, given all of that, and lesser perception, especially given 2 millennia of history and all of those other things that we can talk about, those levels of evidence, the anecdotal, the photographic, artistic, historical, right on up to physical, which is very much in evidence as far as Mr. Phillips talks about. Closing up on Mr. Bishop's segment there, I love the way he closed, that it may be that perhaps UFO updates is the only peer review for ufology available that's online and generally accessible. I thought that was kind of a nice thing to say.
I thought so, too.
And then we roll right into Dave Frelott, where he's talking about UFO updates as an instant and simultaneous access to any informational network available. Wow! You know, I mean, I think it's pretty much true. I think that on a few of the important levels, UFO updates is pretty much the only real, I think, centrist peer review for ufology available. And I think it does provide instant and simultaneous access. It could be a pretty wonderful thing and the salvation of us all. And I'm not the only one thinking so. There's Ralph Abraham, there's Kurzweil, there's Rupert Sheldrake, there's Terrence McKenna. There's many, many, many people are talking about how this internet is just the thing to put us in contact with that other that I was talking about earlier.
And certainly speed up the process.
Very much so.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dave Frelott's sails into the big lie. And I think the big lie is something that really doesn't get talked enough about. And I think it's very significant and important that the big lie is hard to maintain on something like the internet. I think that might be the importance of the internet, that the big lie is no longer possible. And this is forgetting all the big lies by other persons that would be doing big lying, like the late Philip Glass, Oberg, Shermer, Nichols, McGaha, you know, all of these folks. But the big lie, Jonathan Reed, Ray Santilli, the alien autopsy video, all of these things that seem to be handmade, constructed, made machine mechanisms for making UFOs go away. And this last big lie, this secret UN meeting imbroglio that, hey, I had high hopes for that. I thought something was really going to fail with that.
There were certainly websites that hoped it would, and of course, it dropped below the horizon now, and there's all the websites and all of the email lists and all the people that promoted that nonsense haven't withdrawn the nonsense. They've just let it lie there.
Oh, let people figure it out for themselves.
Yeah, you're right about that. To continue on the subject of big lies, I've been hearing in more than a couple of places here lately that the latest false flag operation instituted by my own U.S. government is to institute this New World Order as a result of a phony alien invasion.
I think that's been mentioned on this program in the past.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. We're having to pay the price now, I think, for expressing behavior as a nation that we would not tolerate from any other country in the world, in my opinion. For that matter, I think it's important to get the word out about that particular meme in hopes of precluding same, don't you think?
Yeah, headed off at the pass.
And with regard to conspiracy that this would entail, that this kind of thing is, I'll tell you, you know, when you're waddling around and quacking like a duck, it's hard not to be taken for one.
The problem is there aren't enough bird watchers out there.
Well, on the subject of bird watchers, maybe we don't have bird watchers because we have too many horse feeders.
Oh, my.
Because I remember Furry talking about that, too, and function of UFO update to avoid horse beating. Maybe you could put it up on the site somewhere that UFO updates moderates in black and white to preclude corporal abuse of deceased equines.
No dead horse flogging here.
No. But, you know, to that issue, in every once in a while you get some complaints about your requirement for format and construction when people are trying to submit things to the list. The format and the construction is important to limit the hurdles to information. You know, you're just trying for a nice, clean focus there, and I think you're to be commended for it, and people shouldn't fight you over it too much. I don't mean to disrespect these folks that think they have their teeth in something, and hey, at this point, who am I to say? May even have their teeth in something and, you know, just give it a good shake. I think it's important for us to remember that these are all wonderful people, for the most part, who are sucked up into the information void produced by our conflicted authorities, all of those agencies and institutions and governments that hold sway on the truth, to put a fine point on it. And these entities, these agencies, these governments are pretty much, culture, you know, rounding up the culture. They're just not friendly to truth-seeking individuals. They are not the friend of the truth-seeking individual, and I think that might be important to bring up, too, because that's who these horse beaters are.
Well, the dead horse floggers and the open minders belong together, and they do tend to run together.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, they once again muddy the waters.
In our humble opinion, they muddy the waters, because I'm sure a lot of these people think they have their hand on the truth and are disappointed in the extreme that we won't concede it to them.
Yes.
You know, a situation where there are many people in the States here, and all over the world, too, for that matter, that believe that the United States didn't land on the moon. And I think that belief is the result of a sociological fallout of those governments and systems and cultures that I was talking about earlier, that out of hand, just ordinarily withhold and mislead as a matter of course, and don't disclose. I think if we had faith in our institutions, and our institutions were rationally forthcoming otherwise, there would be no question but that we went to the moon. And how do we know we didn't go to the moon? Because our enemies conceded it. They would have loved to have been able to tell the world that we hoaxed the whole thing on a soundstage. They would love to have said that.
And I don't have much time for those people either.
Me either. Conspiracy's real, though.
Oh, yeah. All kinds of conspiracies going on.
And all kinds of conspiracies. But I think of, you know, my very limited investigation into what sociopathy is all about indicates that there are enough sociopaths in government to not only make it plausible, I think they assure it. I really enjoyed what Furry had to say this time about the big lie. That was not heard enough, and I think we all need to be reminded of that. Good stuff from Dave Frelott this time.
Agreed. And good stuff from everybody, including you, Alfred Lemberg.
Oh, once in a while I do hit the mark. Not very often, but when I do, it's memorable. I remember it.
Every time you're on here, I remember it. Thank
good
you,
night.
Alfred.
We'll see you next time, buddy.
You will, too. Bye, dude.
Standing looking up one day, enjoying the view across the way. Some big bright lights came flying by, a lot of whirling doodads in the sky. It's just imagination, but I saw them just the same.
A bunch of interestings in this program. We covered a pretty big chunk of the ufological sky. My thanks to Dave Frelott, Paul Kimball, Brittany Babakayev, Greg Bishop, Alfred Lemberg, and to you for your continued interest. Spread the word about what you know. It'll eventually make a difference. Next time on SDI, Stuart Miller, Dr. David Clark, and with any luck, someone who can fill us in on the results of the Stephenville case. Until then, au revoir.
That's this edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.